Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the years since 2001, many Americans have come to believe that 9/11 was the opening shot in a war between the West and Islam. Our guest for this first hour of the show, Mark Tesler, who's professor of political science at University of Michigan, says that idea is both troubling and harmful. And among other things, he says it makes it a lot more difficult to understand the real attitudes of average people. This morning in this first hour of the show, our guest, Mark Tesler, will be talking about opinion research in the Muslim world and perhaps talk some about the connections between faith and political involvement. This is something he has done a lot of talking about, thinking about, writing about. He's here visiting the campus and will be giving a couple of talks that are open to the public, and I do want to mention those right at the beginning. He'll be speaking this afternoon, tonight at 7:30 as part of the Millercom series. The title is The View from the Street, Attitudes Toward Politics and Religion Among Ordinary Citizens in the Arab World. That's tonight at 7:30 in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. And then tomorrow he'll be talking as part of the Friday Forum series at the University YMCA. The subject there, Views About the U.S. and the Arab World, What, Why, and Possibilities for Change. This is at noon at the University Y down on the campus. And both of these events are free and open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome to stop by. Also, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Pleasure.
I think in part we have to make reference to this set of ideas that has been promoted since 9/11, and it's been promoted by scholars and I'm sure by commentators and within the media, this idea that what we have here now is a culture clash between the West, meaning there, I suppose, Europe and mm-hmm. the United States, and the Islamic world, and that it's something that we should expect increasingly to be a driver of conflict. What's wrong with that idea?
Well, it's not really supported by the evidence, at least not the kind of evidence that I have. We've been doing a very large number of public opinion surveys, and I should say we is an American team, but with leadership provided by a very strong team of people from a number of countries. We're only working in the Arab world, so this is not about all Muslim countries. And we're not in every single Arab country, but we've been in Iraq, we've been in rich countries like Kuwait, we've been in poor countries like Yemen, we've been way over on the side of the Arab world in Algeria and Morocco. These are big national representative samples, thousands of people, a lot of rigor in terms of selecting the questions and pretesting them. So we have we have a lot of evidence about what ordinary people think. And if we, as I'm doing in my research, remain at that level of analysis. I mean, if we want to talk about political parties or what some imam said, that's a different kind of analysis. We might have something to say on that. But in terms of what I've been talking about and what my research is really focused on, it's this very systematic and we think scientific and rigorous set of findings about what ordinary people think. Just men and women in the street, like men and women in the street here.
Yeah.
And everything that comes through in the data, I mean, it isn't that they necessarily love America. There's a nuanced view. We'll maybe get to that in a little while. But everything that comes through in the data is inconsistent with or contradicts this clash of civilizations thesis, the notion that why is there anti-Americanism? Well, they hate our freedoms. Or what kind of a religion is Islam? Well, it's best summed up by Islamofascism. These are terms that are floating around. You don't find them too much in serious scholarly work, but there are some scholars who have articulated some of these points of view. So, I mean, you can find examples of that. I would say most of the scholarly opinions of a very different sort. But you do find it on talk radio. You do find it in some of the public circles. And people think they know what Islam is. And if you want to know what's wrong with these people, why are they – don't they have democracy? Why are they belligerent? Why don't they like us? Islam is the answer. Well, it's not the answer, at least not in terms of what's shaping individual attitudes and values.
Yeah. Just to make one further point, and I think that it's probably important to make – first of all, you said that the work that you had done was within Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
And we tend to talk about the Muslim world or the Islamic world like it was this monolithic mm-hmm. entity. And you have to acknowledge the fact that if you look at countries where the population is predominantly Muslim, they're very different. And you should be very careful about making pronouncements about what Muslims think just because from one country to the next, people are very different. Their priorities are different. Their cultures are different. And yet at the same time, we do talk as if somehow all Muslims
sure.
were all reading off the same page.
Well, the most populous Muslim country or Muslim majority country is Indonesia, much, much larger and more populous than any Arab country. Pakistan, there's a very large in Malaysia. There's really a lot of countries. Turkey too, Iran too, which is not an Arab country. In general, even though people use the terms interchangeably, I mean just ordinary people who are kind of just looking over there and saying, well, they're Muslims over there, use them interchangeably, and that's quite inappropriate for the reason you said. I think most of the stereotypes that people have or that are floating around, I don't want to say everybody has them, but that we're here in part to talk about, most of those stereotypes, even though people might say that's has to do with Muslims, in their mind I think is probably an Arab in terms of when they're thinking about what the person looks like, where they're located. So they are very different, but I think the stereotypes, even though they're sometimes articulated in terms of Islam or the Islamic elements that we find to be predominant in the Arab world, some of this kind of conversation we're beginning to have, I think, applies particularly to the Arab world. You don't get nearly as much of a sense as, well, you know, why are we having all these problems with the Indonesians? Or why are we having all these problems with the Turks? And it's not the whole story. I mean, Pakistan comes in and there's an Islamic dimension there. Iran comes in. So it's not only the Arab world. But I think the Arab world, having acknowledged that that's only one important but ultimately limited part of the Muslim world, is to some extent the center of the debate we're talking about. And we think about Saudi Arabia or some of the other countries, and we get statements like, why are we sending our oil money to these countries that hate us? So, I mean, there's all these unidimensional, stereotypic views. There is some anti-Americanism there, and we should be asking ourselves how we understand it, where it comes from, what it's all about. Is there any legitimacy to it from the point of view of people over there? If we were in their position, would we think the same thing? Or are they totally distorted? And we have to figure out a way to kind of get them to see their distortion. But it's not about Islam, and I think we'll probably probe that a little bit more deeply as we go along.
Well, let me ask you about just this basic question. If you do go out and you go out on the Arab street and you ask you just stop people, you ask people, and you try to do a representative sample of average of average people. And you start asking them questions about what they think about the United States, the U.S. government, American people. What kind of responses do you get?
Well, I'll give you the systematic answer based on the data in a second. I'll give you a short answer that just if you just went out and randomly found somebody, it wasn't a systematic sample, which, of course, we have done, where you're really careful about how you select respondents and to pay attention to the way you ask the questions and word order effects, and there's all kinds of things you have to kind of pay attention to. But if you just went out and asked people, the odds are you would get the following, which I and colleagues of mine have often got. When you go back to the U.S., Mr. American, give my love to the American people. They're great. And tell the American president to go to hell. That sums up what comes through pretty clearly in the surveys. If you ask people about American democracy. First, if you ask people if they want democracy, yes, they do. And they're very unhappy they don't have it. And there's interesting in why they don't have it and what discourages it. That's an interesting question that we can come to. Islam is offered as one of the reasons. Doesn't seem to be a very convincing reason, but it is offered. It have to do with the U.S. I mean, aren't we out there promoting democracy? Didn't we go to Iraq to promote democracy? Isn't Iraq doing well now? So isn't democracy flourishing? So there's a lot to talk about, but people want democracy. Mm-hmm. If you ask them about democracy in the U.S., in general, it gets high marks. Yes, America is very democratic. Not everybody says that. They have some complaints. Some of the complaints aren't necessarily fully informed, just like we're not fully informed about their society. But in general, in terms of the dominant perception, America is a democratic society, and we get credit for that. If you ask people, what about American culture? What about American science? What about American education? What about American media? I was kind of surprised about the media because you think that somehow this might be offending their sensitivities. You get a bit of a mixed response, and there's also some variation from place to place and from generation to generation if you compare older and younger people. But the bottom line that comes through is people are positive on all of these things. Their views about American society and these different aspects of American society are positive. If you ask them about the American administration, and especially if you ask them about American foreign policy, the views are going to be diametrically in the opposite way. So there is a great deal of not only discontent but anger in our policy. So there's a sort of schizophrenia in how many people look at the U.S., stands for wonderful things, organized a great society. Probably we have some problems they're maybe not even aware of, but they give us credit for really being a place they'd like to be. And yet, this society, with its democracy, has produced these policies that that anger them so much. And so there's a great deal of anti-Americanism, but it is focused on the issues that – on the things that they think we are doing in their region. And the questions that come, are we really doing these things? Are we guilty of what they accuse us of? If we are there good reason for them doing them nonetheless, or aren't we to reexamine our policy? And that's where some of this leads.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Mark Tesler. He's professor of political science at the University of Michigan. He specializes in comparative politics and Middle East studies. He's done field research in a number of places in the Arab world, Tunisia, Israel, Morocco, Egypt, West Bank and Gaza, and has been involved in doing opinion research to try and get at the attitudes of average people in the Middle East on some of the issues that here we've talked about. He's here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a couple of talks. I will, again, around midway through, tell you about where and when you can hear more from him. And, of course, here on the program, questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I have a caller here I would get to in a moment. Just one further question. I'm sure that you also asked people what they thought about their own governments. And what do you see, and do people's attitudes toward their own government tell you anything about their political beliefs more generally, and perhaps also this question about, well, what they think about the West?
This is an excellent question. If we were to kind of make a list of things that might be the questions we want to ask to try and understand why people come to the conclusions they do. They tend to have very negative views of their country. They want democracy. They don't have it. They're upset about corruption. They're upset about the gap between rich and poor. They're upset about the way resources are used. They're upset about the suppression of freedom. There's some questions we can't ask. They're too politically sensitive, or to ask them might put our interviewers in danger. But we can ask enough to know that this is the way most people feel. So there's a very negative view. It's a little bit of variation from country to country. Some countries do better and get somewhat higher marks. We are generalizing about 325 million people in 24 countries. But in general, the dominant theme is the one I said. That having been said, if we ask where does that fit into the way that people's own experiences shape what they think about a whole variety of things, in this case about the U.S., or let's say about terrorism. In contrast to religious orientations, if we were to – I hope I'm not bringing in too many things at once here, but if we were to say, well, you know, if a person is more religious, would that make them more anti-Western? Mm-hmm. Or if a person was more religious, had a deeper involvement in his religion, either through his practice or his beliefs or his involvement in the rituals – would he be more likely to be anti-American or less likely to be supportive of democracy or more supportive of terrorism? The answer to those questions is no. Having a deeper religious attachment, being a more committed, involved Muslim doesn't predict at all. In a statistical sense, it doesn't explain why some people are more anti-American, others are less. Some people are more supportive of democracy and less. Some people are more tolerant of terrorism. They may not say I like the method, but I can understand, given the provocation, why people would do this. And some people don't take that point of view. Knowing where a person stands with respect to his religion doesn't tell us very much, doesn't give us any explanatory power. Knowing what he thinks about his government gives us a lot of explanatory power. So in general, people have very negative views. But some people are more negative than others, and those who are more negative tend to be more interested in democracy, more interested, more anti-American. And among the list of complaints they have is that, you know, I'm blending a bunch of things here, but why, you know, why do we live in these circumstances? How come we have these authoritarian governments that we dislike so much? And how come we have this, we have wealth? Not every country is rich, but a lot of countries have wealth. Why isn't it more shared? Why don't we have, why do we have this gap between rich and poor? Why, if you go to Egypt, can you see Mercedes lined up outside the big hotels for $100,000 and $200,000 weddings while people are living in garbage dumps? You know, who makes this possible? Well, the first culprit is, of course, their own government, who and the small class of people that benefit from this. But that government has some important international allies that help them a lot. Now, whether and we're at the top of that list. We can ask a question about whether we deserve that blame. I mean, are we really responsible? Do we really share? We ask people on the surveys another question about who is primarily responsible for the problems of your country. We ask this in each of in seven countries for this air barometer part. There are many other surveys as well we did. And at the top of the list was their own government. Most people felt, first and foremost comes my own government, leaders who are maybe even manipulating the Americans to get support for their own ends that don't serve the people. But not too far behind comes the U.S., who's probably willing to be manipulated or a willing partner in this because we get what we want, moderation toward Israel, access to oil, handing over some prisoners or torturing some other prisoners in the war on terror, not too much criticism of Iraq. So we're sort of seen as part of the problem. And that combination really explains a lot when you look at the different things we've been looking at, attitudes toward the U.S., attitudes toward terrorism, attitudes toward democracy and governance. These are all the issues that I've been exploring. And in addition to trying to figure out, in general, what are the dominant lines or tendencies in terms of what people think, what are the experiences that lead people to the views they have? Some of this is controversial, and one can say, well, it's not fair to criticize the U.S. this way, and somehow I'd better go over and tell these people that we're not doing anything like what they think we're doing. Personally, I'm not sure that's the case, but that's the conversation that comes with this.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have several callers here. Let's bring some of them into the conversation, and we will start with someone in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd like to bring up some questions and then listen on the radio to your responses. First, I'd like you to broaden a little your focus and see if you could at least address this, because you talked about attitudes towards the U.S. I wonder if you could talk about attitudes towards toleration, specifically toleration of other religious traditions, whether you say Christianity, whether it's the indigenous Christians within Arab countries where those exist, or Christians in the U.S. or in Western Europe, attitudes towards Jews, attitudes towards non-believers, attitudes towards Buddhists, Hindus. So that's one direction. The other part, another part, is I'd like you to talk about not only attitudes towards America, but attitudes towards Great Britain, Germany, Holland, all of which are countries, or France, all of which are countries which have large Muslim, not necessarily Arab, let's say in Britain it's mostly Southeast Asian, but large Muslim populations and have large issues with the Muslim population in terms of acculturation and in terms of, quote, culture conflict, whether it has to do with the laws, family issues, Sharia, etc. Mm-hmm. So that's one part. And then I'd like to also ask you to talk about the differences between, let us say, the attitudes in among Pakistanis, to the extent that you can, and, let us say, Arabs, because you've made that distinction as a significant issue in terms of, let's say, towards so-called terrorism or so-called use of things like suicide, bombing, and those sorts of things. I know I've thrown up thrown open this a lot of different areas that are somewhat tangential, but I would hope that you could address this.
Okay. Well, I think there – I probably can't say much about the third one, so I'll kind of roll that out at the beginning. I haven't done any work in Pakistan or any of the other non-Muslim countries. Did a little bit of work in Turkey with a student of mine, but I'm not a specialist in Turkey and I don't have reams of data. So to the extent that other Muslim populations are different or the same, it's beyond the scope of what I have to comment on. I will say that we're putting in a large proposal to do a much broader expansion of this kind of work, to go back to the Arab countries we've been working in, but we want to go to Muslim-majority countries in East Asia and Pakistan and South Asia as well. And we are going to do significant minorities in France, in Germany, in Russia, in Spain. So it's a big grant and kind of – I don't know if it's realistic to hope we're going to get it, but we've put together a really good proposal because I think this is really important. But we don't have those data yet. The first question about tolerance is the one that I can say the most about. It's a very good and important question. And the data show – and this was in the presentation I made last night, and it'll be in the presentation I'm going to make tonight. It's not a central focus, but I do address it because it comes – it's important, and I have some data on it. I presented responses to three questions that have to do with tolerance. And we have more in the survey instrument, but I don't remember all the details, but I do remember the three because we just talked about this last night. One was how important is it that when you decide who is a political leader that you would support or what's considered an important qualification for public office that or political leadership that the person that you're asked to make a judgment of is open to diverse political views and has and believes in giving all points of view a fair hearing. So that's not quite the way the question is worded, but it's at the political level. Do you want to be governed by people who are committed to pluralism and tolerance in discourse? Second, there's a question of interaction with people, sort of standard social distance measures, interaction with people in your neighbor. Who would you be happy to have or unhappy to have as neighbors? People of a different race, people of a different religion. The one that we gave last night was about race. And the third question was about gender equality, which is a different kind of tolerance, but I think belongs on the list as well. We have a lot of questions about the different roles that would or wouldn't be appropriate for men or for women, opportunities for mixing. And in all three of these areas, two things came through. One, that the numbers were pretty high. In the 70% to 90% of people giving a more progressive or more democratic or more tolerant response, I'd be prepared to acknowledge there might be a little of inflation there because it's sometimes hard for – going through this in our own country with the election surveys for people to say, no, I mean I really I just don't like blacks and I don't want them in my neighborhood. I mean we tried to ask the question in a way and embed it in a series, a network of questions so that we could get an honest opinions. But there may be a little of inflation. But even accounting – discounting that – what comes through is very high levels of at least at the level of expression, people articulating a view that emphasizes tolerance. The second part of this – so that's one. The numbers in general are high across all the countries for which we have data and with respect to at least these three very different kinds of tolerance. And two, Islam has no bearing on this. People who are more religious don't turn out to be less tolerant. We also asked people, what kind of a democracy do you want? There was there's a very interesting debate that's going on in the Arab world, and an important debate for these countries, and it has some resonance in the U.S. or in Israel, where people are trying to figure out how much or little what should be the place of religion in the political process. Is there a place for it, or do we need a really rigid separation? And the specifics aren't the same in every country. But in general, there is this debate about, I want democracy. I want mechanisms by which I can hold the government accountable. But I want it in an Islamic framework. I want there to be a role for Islamic institutions, or I want Islamic law to be one of the things we take into consideration when we legislate, or I want some structural arrangement. So there are people who say, I want Islam to be part of the – I want an Islamic democracy. And then we get into questions about what that means, and we're trying to go a little bit more deeply. It means different things to different people. If you know something about Israel, as I suspect you may, there's certainly a debate there about whether certain kinds of religious laws should be the law of the land or not, and it's not exactly the same. But and then there are a lot of other people, roughly half, it varies a little bit from country to country, who say, no, I want a separation between religion and politics. Having religion in will be bad for politics. It will also corrupt religion. And for either one reason or both, I want it out. So there's a big division of opinion on this. If you go back to those democratic values or those values of tolerance that I mentioned at the beginning, you say, well, maybe might it be the case that the people who want democracy but want it with an Islamic dimension, maybe they don't possess democratic values quite as much as the people who want democracy and they want it to be secular. And if you said that, you'd be wrong. The level of support for, at least at the rhetorical level in terms of what people say when they're interviewed, the degree to which people articulate these values of tolerance in these three different domains, politics, personal life, and gender relations, are equally high among those who want secular democracy and those who want democracy, however defined, with an Islamic orientation. So I would say this question of tolerance, I mean, I'm kind of going on at some length because I think it's a really important question, and it pertains to the kind of thing about which maybe none of the listeners today, but Americans in general, often have some pretty strong misconceptions. I think most people would say, well, yeah, I mean, Islam doesn't breed tolerance, and there probably isn't much tolerance there to begin with. And among people who are deeper ties to their religion, it's probably even lower still. And the data just don't support that. In terms of your question about Europe, we do have some questions on it, but I don't have the findings in front of me, and I don't think we probed it as deeply as we would need to have done to answer your question specifically. But I would say, to the extent that I could make a comment, I would say in those questions where we talk about things that are just Western, so there's a question U.S. and Western culture. So it's not just America, but it's America and other Western countries. People don't seem to distinguish too much. When we go country by country, it seems that this is a bit of a generalization. I'd have to really spend more time with the data to be sure I'm giving you a fully accurate answer. But the countries are judged to some extent by their foreign policy. So the countries that are more deeply involved in Iraq, like Britain, or were at the time, we did the surveys. These were done in 2006 and 2007. Britain got was more criticism of Britain. And France, which was known for standing up for opposing our policy, got higher marks. So to some extent, there were other questions that we would have needed to ask to really get at what you're looking at. And maybe we have a few of them that I can go back and look at. In general, that wasn't the focus of this research. But if we just talk about the country itself, it was the perception of the country's foreign policy had a lot to do with what people thought about it. The last thing on this is we did ask, how much democracy, what do you think of American democracy? We also said, what do you think of British democracy and French democracy? It's maybe not exactly what you're asking, but on those dimensions, the country's got high marks.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. I have some other callers we'll get right to, but I do want to introduce again our guest, Mark Tesler. He is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and is interested in the politics of the Middle East. He studied or done field research in a number of countries, including Tunisia, Israel, Morocco, Egypt, and Palestine. One of the few American scholars to have attended university and lived for long periods of time in both the Arab world and in Israel. He's also spent several years teaching and consulting in sub-Saharan Africa and has been involved in, as he has explained, opinion research in the Arab world, asking people some very basic questions about their attitudes towards politics, their own governments, toward the United States. He is here in Champaign-Urbana and will give two talks. Let me just mention again quickly that he'll be talking tonight at 7:30 at the Knight Auditorium at the Spurlock Museum. This is a part of the MillerCom series, The View from the Street, Attitudes Toward Politics and Religion Among Ordinary Citizens in the Arab World. He'll also be speaking tomorrow at noon as part of the YMCA Friday Forum series, Views About the U.S. in the Arab World. That's tomorrow at noon. They're both open to anybody who would like to attend. Let's get back to calls, and we have someone in here from Danville, I believe, and this was line number 3. Hello.
Yes, Professor Tesler. Are you familiar with the film, DVD, Zeitgeist?
No, I'm not.
It's kind of a cult thing that purports theories that there was no plane at the Pentagon crashing, that it was a government explosion type thing, that one of the passports survived the fire from the plane of the crash at the World Trade Center. Six of the 19 hijackers are still alive and free. It shows President Bush as a puppet for bankers going back to his grandfather, Prescott Bush. This, the film tries to mitigate the action of the Arab people involved in this and throw it back to an FBI involvement here. It sounds kind of wild, but the film is well made. It has a lot of other ideas in it having to do with conspiratorial type things, which is not necessarily academic.
I don't know the film. I don't believe I've ever heard of it. I can't say that it sounds very credible based on your description of it, but I haven't seen it. A question that I would ask, or that people listening might want to ask, is who made it? Who funded it? Where did the resources to produce this come from? And what would be the political agenda of the people who did that? And then that might inform how much credibility you'd attach to it. But I would say that about anything. I mean, I don't know the film.
Just as a basic question, let me ask, would there be any doubt in your mind that the more conventional narrative explaining what happened and why you would say, as far as you're concerned, that seems to be the story, that the more familiar story we know is the story?
Yes. I mean, I'm responding as a citizen with the same basis of information that you have. It isn't informed by any of my research. I will say that we did ask some questions about 9/11, and the responses were interesting, but we didn't get responses, well, I don't even know why you're asking. It was all a hoax. I mean, that wasn't something that we heard. So it's outside the bounds of what I can talk about in terms of my research and my evidence, so I'm just responding as an American citizen who lived through that. I've been at 7 years at the University of Michigan, and my first day was September 11th, 2001. I was supposed to go down and teach a class, and I got a call just beforehand. So, I mean, I think everybody remembers where they were at the time. So I don't have any reason to think that the conventional explanation is not correct. Yeah. But
well, that's probably about the best response we can give. I appreciate the caller. Thanks. Let's go to somebody else. This is Urbana, and would be line number one. Hello. The caller there in Urbana, line one. Okay.
Hello, line one.
Yes, go ahead.
Thanks, sir. There is a lot of misconception and misunderstanding on the reasons for 9/11 and for the views in the Middle East or in the Islamic region about the America and the U.S. and this 9/11. It was obvious from the beginning that this is the case. There is a misconception and misunderstanding, and many people expressed the opinion, which is now Ron Paul's opinion, that the politics of the U.S. is a kind of reason for that. But there would be necessarily a huge effort to remove such misconceptions and misunderstandings set a system to solve, to put the things in a rational order. So one of those things would be a huge institute for researching and finding the ways to improve this understanding and remove misconceptions. What do you think about what would take to eliminate this misconceptions in a practical way, so for the future to avoid or improve that situation. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. There's some very good parts to that question that I'd like to address. First, let me start off with 9/11 and then about the misconceptions and what it would take to address it. We asked people questions about 9/11. We didn't ask it every place. There have been a number of different surveys, but we asked it a number of times. And excuse me, the response was and we described kind of what it was in, I should say, our partners described it in. And in fact, I will also say that I wasn't going to – I was a little hesitant to have asked some of this. I don't think it felt – well, in our – the AIR partners who were, you know, team leaders of these projects, no, this is really important. We need to kind of investigate it. And there are questions about domestic terrorism too, terrorism directed against people in those countries. I mean they were just – they think it's an important issue. So we asked the question, I think, in a fairly objective way that didn't lead people. The distribution of responses we got is as follows. Varies a little bit from country to country, but as a generalization, about 80% disapproved of it and about 20% approved. Of the 80% who disapproved, most disapproved strongly, and then the rest just disapproved. There you can see there was like a 4.4 choices on this particular question. Of those who approved, about half just approved, so a total of 10%, and about half approved strongly. So overwhelmingly, there is not approval, but there is more approval than one might wish. 20% is a lot, and 10% who approve strongly is a lot. So one, that's at least an indication of how people are thinking about this. It goes up and down from time to time. If there's some big event or we do something or something else happens, it can drive the numbers up, it can drive the numbers down, but that's kind of a fair approximation. We then asked, and this connects with the way I was kind of describing the stuff about democracy and Islam earlier, well, what do we know about the 20% who approve as opposed to the 80% who don't, or the 10% who approve strongly as opposed to the 80% who don't, or the 40% who disapprove strongly? Again, religion has nothing to do with it. Those two categories do not differ in their religiosity. They don't differ in their cultural orientations, whether they're more conservative on questions of gender or other things. They don't differ – well, there's a whole list of things they don't differ with. I don't have to go through the list. They also don't differ with respect to poverty, whether they're poorer or less well-educated. What they differ in are two things, a little bit more in this, but basically two things. One is what you might expect, discontent with strong discontent with U.S. policy, kind of the view that, well – I don't exactly like this, but what do you expect us to do under these circumstances, given what America's doing to us? But even more important is the thing you asked me about at the very beginning, their own view of their government. Mm-hmm. The people who are the most critical of their government are most likely to be in the approved category. So that's just a little bit. I mean, it maybe puts it in perspective. It says, yeah, there is some support for it, and yeah, it's disturbing, but overwhelmingly it's opposition that's the norm. And among those who do support it, they're not driven by some cultural or religious or Arabist or Islamic impulse. They're driven by the judgments they're making, informed or uninformed, simplistic or not, about the political circumstance in which they live. So it's their political assessment that's driving this. In terms of sort of getting yes, I think that the easy answer is yes, some sort of a program or an institute or a project or a series of projects that promotes better that tries to do away with the misconceptions on both sides, because people have misconceptions about us just as we have misconceptions about them, is absolutely critical. And it's an important part, in a small way. I think we need to be kind of modest, or I need to be kind of modest. But in a small way, it's a very important part of what this work is all about. On the one hand, it tries to be very scientific and rigorous in terms of doing the research so we can have confidence in the data. And some of the things we do with the data are to publish our little scholarly articles, which as professors we think are important, and you won't convince us they're not important. But there's a lot of other things we're trying to do as well. We have a major outreach and dissemination project. We have a website, most of which is in Arabic, to kind of share some of this information with people in the Arab world and hopefully get dialogues going. I was recently in Norway at the invitation of the Norwegian Center for the Advancement of Democracy, something like that, where they brought political party leaders from a number of Arab countries. And they had a whole had a 2.5-day program, but they wanted the keynote to be presentation of these findings. You know, here's a chance for you political party leaders in the Arab world to hear what your people are saying. And, you know, if you want, you can say, well, they couldn't be saying that. You must be flawed in your methods. Or, yeah, I guess they are saying that. We got to think about it. Mm-hmm. And so my job was not to give my own opinion, but to put the voice of ordinary men and women on the table. And then these leaders had to figure out what they thought about it and what they were gonna, how they were going to respond. We've been publishing country reports that are on our website in they're in English too. So I mean, we hope that Americans will look at this and be disabused of some of their stereotypes. We hope that people in the Arab world will log on and read it in English or in Arabic, and no one's asking them to change their politics. I mean, they should. Their experience is going to shape what they think, but to have this information that undermines, we hope. I mean, it does what it does. It's not for me to say, I hope, but it does undermine some of the simplistic and misconceptions about why, how people think of the U.S., what they like, what they don't like about the U.S., what Islam does and does not explain. So we're trying to kind of provide a factual basis for, as opposed to, you know, it's Islamofascism and that's all you need to know, and what's this professor presenting all this garbage for? So, I mean, that's where – so we have a strong outreach and dissemination activity to try to get this into the public discourse in our country and in the Middle East.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest is Mark Tesler. He's professor of political science at the University of Michigan. We have another caller here, Champaign County. Let's get to them. Line 2. Hello.
Hi. The pundit class seems to have bought what I'll call, just for purposes of expression, Huntington Lewis kind of theory of clash of mm-hmm. civilizations. What is the state in academia, in your realm? We have the example of your colleague Juan Cole being prevented from going to Columbia, I think led by Campus Watch and Daniel Pipes. So I'm just wondering if you have anything to say about that and your experience with any of that. I mean, it's fairly clear that this class of civilizations is dominant in the military and in the pundit class, but I'm just wondering what kind of uphill battle you have inside of academia itself.
I would say it's sort of mixed. I'm not sure what you're referring to with respect to Juan Cole. I think maybe thinking of Yale, which is where he was perhaps going to go, and we were very happy that we were able to keep him at Michigan. If you're referring to him actually taking a position, I don't think it was Columbia. I know it was Yale.
Okay, well, that's it.
That's not the point, of course. You got to give Huntington credit, because here we are. I'm trying to think when that book was first published. I think it was 1993, if I remember right. 15 years after he wrote this, I mean, people are still talking about it. His phrase, and actually, it's Bernard Lewis's phrase. I mean, Huntington got it from him. Bernard Lewis used it first. I would say that that view is not particularly prominent. I mean, to some extent, this remains a contested issue, so you'll find people on both sides. I haven't taken a poll, and this probably isn't the thing you would take a poll on. But I would say, in terms of people who study the region or international politics, certainly people who study the Middle East, the substantial majority do not subscribe to that. And the complaint on the other side would be that these people don't get enough attention. And, I mean, I know from 10 of your comments that you don't agree with that, and I don't agree with it either. But in terms of the first part of your question, sort of what are some of the dominant trends in the academic field, I would say the view articulated by Lewis and Huntington and Pipes and Martin Kramer and some others who we all know is not a dominant view. I think they would probably themselves acknowledge that they're on the defensive, and that's why they feel they need to reach out and strive for more balance from their point of view. As far as beyond that, it varies considerably from place to place. There are definitely episodes that people who know this field will point to. Tenure case at DePauw. I mean, probably most of the listeners won't know what we're referring to, and I suspect the caller has a number of things pretty specific in mind. So there are cases where this comes up and leads to interference in terms of people not being invited to campuses or people not being having problems with tenure. There are some cases, and they're disturbing. My own experience, which is really what I have to draw on, is that this is significant. I mean, actually, there were a group of us who wrote an article in one of the leading political science journals about the politics of being engaged in Middle East studies. But I would say more often than not, it's just noise in the background. Maybe that's going too far because I don't want to trivialize this. It can be important. And I also need to add that neither side has a monopoly on it. I mean, we see some attempts to suppress dissent or make sure one point of view is the real point of view that gets heard. Maybe the people you're talking about do it more because they're better organized and they have more resources. But that's very troubling. But I've seen it often enough on the other side as well to know that nobody has a monopoly on it. Having said that, I would say nonetheless, I don't feel, at least in my own experience, meaning the places I've been and what I've seen, not just me personally, that this has been troubling, but not to the point of really preventing us from having the kind of meaningful discussions and research that we want. Yeah.
We have 2-3 minutes left. I want to get back to this, to the earlier caller's notion about how it is we address misunderstandings. And after 2011, the U.S. government launched an effort. It seems to me it's been sort of scattered and fragmented, or they're not quite sure how to do it. But the idea was that what we need to do is launch a public relations effort in the Middle East to try to get people to understand America better, and that if they did, maybe they would change their attitudes. From your opportunity to talk to people, do you see any evidence that that effort by the U.S. government has been at all successful?
No, it hasn't. It's too bad. I mean, it was called public diplomacy. They set up an assistant secretary of state for public diplomacy. The first person they brought in was
Karen Hughes.
Karen Hughes from she's the more recent one. But the first one was why am I drawing a blank on her name? Anyway, they did these videos called Shared Values. And they showed Muslims living well in the U.S. It was one was a small baker in Toledo and how he came here with nothing and made his way. And another was Zerhouni, who is the of Algerian origin, who's the prince, who at the time was head of the National Institutes of Health. So showing how – and my response was these are really well done and these are really heartwarming stories. Ordinary Americans ought to see it because we should know more about our own country. But over there – they had no impact because what they're saying is America is a democratic society. Well, people aren't disputing that. Americans are good people. People aren't disputing that. American culture is open and tolerant. People aren't disputing that. So it didn't address. And they ultimately pulled the plug on it because it was the diplomats told them this is having no effect. If you want to really get through to people, you need to talk about the things that are shaping American opinion and opinions of America. And it's not this stuff. Same thing with Karen Hughes, and there was Margaret Tutwiler in between. And the response has been the same for all of them. If you want to – we had a conference on this at the National Defense University a couple of years ago, and a book came out of it if people are interested. and it's – if you want to really get at what's driving people's opinions, you need to talk about Iraq. You need to talk about Guantanamo. You need to talk about Palestine. You can defend your point of view, but if you don't address those things, you're not going to – you're preaching to the choir on things that are irrelevant.
Yeah. Maybe just one other thing, and we don't have very much time, and you have touched on it, but it goes back to this idea about connections between religion and politics. And here in this country, we seem to believe – we practice this imperfectly, but we seem to believe there should be some break between the two, even though I'm sure there are people who would say their faith influences their political activity. I think people have this idea that it is more common for Muslims to say, my faith does indeed dictate my political involvement, and that they would say, you can't have a separation between church and state. If you ask people in their own – say in your own personal life, how much does your religious faith, do you think, dictate your attitudes when it comes to politics?
Well, we didn't ask the question that way, so I can only make a guess. But we did ask people a lot of questions about the ways in which their faith is important to them and how they involve. We have questions about, if you think about what you want to be the characteristics of the person that your son or daughter will marry, and then we give certain kinds of things. So we can have a sense of of where a person is with respect to his or her faith. And we can see whether or not there is any relationship between the way they answer those questions and their views about a lot of things. And in that sense, there isn't very much of a connection. Not to say we didn't ask them, do you think there's a connection? But, I mean, that's the way we investigated that. Religion is important. I mean, I don't want people to come away with the view that therefore somehow Islam is not important. It's a religion that people should understand a little bit more what it really is all about. It is important to people's lives, and it's part of the political discourse, as I said. But since I know we've got to wrap up, but it doesn't have the explanatory power in terms of why people think this way about America or why they don't like democracy or something else. Those are the stereotypes that come with clash of civilization arguments, and those are the ones that are not supported by the data.
Well, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, you have two more opportunities to hear some more from our guest on these subjects. Our guest, Mark Tesler, who's professor of political science at University of Michigan. He'll be giving a talk in the MillerCom series tonight at 7:30. This is The View from the Street, Attitudes Toward Politics and Religion Among Ordinary Citizens in the Arab World. This is at the Knight Auditorium in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. And then he'll be speaking as part of the YMCA Friday Forum series tomorrow, beginning at noon at the University Y down on the campus, talking about views about the U.S. in the Arab world, what, why, and possibilities for change. Both of them open to the public. Anyone who would want to attend should feel welcome so that you can stop by. And to you, Professor Tesler, thanks very much for being here.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.